from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, I put out a call last week for nominations for replacement homes for the homeless, because there are stirrings in Santa Monica. The downtown businessmen are agitating, don't you know, for laws against sleeping in doorways. How's a person supposed to sleep in a window? So I said, maybe this won't be the home of the homeless for long. Tom Clark writes me to faithfully submit the fine city of Palo Alto, California. It's home of venture capital, he writes, but it's also home to an enormous homeless population. I don't mean the homeless people are enormous, Tom jokes, just that there are a lot of them. I work in the downtown area, and every day I see, mixed in with the Stanford students and ultra-rich Silicon Valley types, vagrants wandering the streets with plastic bags on their feet and toothless men screaming Bible passages from the street corners, and not to mention the public urination and worse in front of the University Avenue Starbucks. So if you're serious about moving the official designation away from Santa Monica, I would urge you to pay a visit to Palo Alto and take a whiff for yourself, writes Tom from the relative safety of San Jose. All right, so nominations are open. If you have reasons why your community or a community near you or a community that scares you should be the new home of the homeless, you just let me know, okay? Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, two people who probably should be either barred from defending themselves or should go into law practice together are James Traficant and Zacharias Moussaoui. Not really, you know, when lawyers say a man who represents himself as a fool for a client, these guys, they just point to these two, and who knew? We learned this week that James Traficant all his time was wearing a toupee, ladies and gentlemen. That wasn't his own. Well, it was his hair. He paid for it. And two gentlemen in trouble. Both of them running for office at opposite ends of the country, as it turns out. In New Jersey, Senator Bob Torricelli took to the Senate floor this week and said, yes, you're right, I did violate Senate rules, mea culpa, mea maxima culpa. He didn't quite apologize. If he apologized, I didn't see it on the tape, but he did everything but apologize. He said he took personal responsibility. That's what he did. He took personal responsibility for accepting these gifts from David Chang, which he has reportedly later paid back. And he's running for re-election, and there's some talk that may be trouble for him. On the West Coast, running against a very unpopular governor in California is Bill Simon, businessman Bill Simon. Now, Bill Simon had the bad fortune to get into the campaign as a businessman who can bring business-like practices to the governing of the state of California. Had the bad timing to do that this year. In the Enron WorldCom time frame. Worse than that, a company which he'd founded, he wasn't running it at the time, but he'd founded it with his brother and his late father, an investment company, was found liable this week by a California jury for business fraud and fined $78 million in punitive damages. That's going to hurt. That's going to hurt a campaign. And what was that company engaged in? What among which businesses was it investing? Payphones. He's going to bring that kind of business expertise and know-how. Payphones, ladies and gentlemen. He was asked by the local dog trainer in Los Angeles, who uses payphones? And he answered that his wife, Cindy, had asked him the same question. Why do you want to invest in a payphone company, he quoted her as asking. Nobody uses payphones anymore. To which he replied, quote, no matter how much mobile phones come in, there's always going to be a need for payphones. I think he's going to be needing one very, very soon. Hello, welcome to the show.
such a really bad feeling about who's. It's like trying to stand up when you've been hit by a gust of wind. I've spent so many years just hanging around. Now it's time to go back to my hometown. You know, London is calling. I don't understand it, but I'm on my way. I don't need a reason. Feels like holiday season, and I'm on my way back to Blighty again. Again. Well, I got a really bad feeling, man. Hard to sort out, it's too hard to discuss. Well, I've spent so many years just hanging around. Now it's a time to go back to my hometown. You know, London is calling. I don't understand it, but I'm on my way. I don't need a reason. Feels like holiday season, and I'm on my way back to Blighty. Filthy weather. Sometimes what I wouldn't give for a late ride in a black cab or a double decker. 'Cause I got a really bad feeling about who's trying to stand up and you've been hit by a gust of wind. Well, so many things I don't really understand. It's like trying to be a woman. It's like trying to be a good man. You know, London is calling. I don't understand it, but I'm on my way. I don't need a reason. Feels like holiday season, and I'm on my way back to Blighty again. Yeah, I'm back to Blighty again. Yeah, I'm back to Blighty again.
here.
Bananeira, não sei, bananeira, sei lá. A bananeira, sei, uma maneira de ver. Bananeira, não sei, bananeira, sei lá. A bananeira, sei lá, isso ela com você será. Do fundo do quintal, quintal do seu olhar, olhar do coração. Bananeira, sei, não, uma maneira de ter. Bananeira, não sei, bananeira, sei lá. A bananeira, sei lá, isso é lá com você. Bananeira, não sei, bananeira, sei lá. A bananeira, sei, não, uma maneira de ver. Bananeira, não sei, bananeira, sei lá. A bananeira, sei lá, isso é lá com você. Será do fundo do quintal, quintal do seu olhar, olhar do coração. Oh,
From the edge of America, from still the home of the homeless, often imitated, seldom imitated. I'm Harry, I'm meaning the city, not me. I'm Gary Kroger imitated me, I know that, once. I'm going to get you, he kept saying. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. Gosh, that was a weird digression. But ladies and gentlemen, talk about burying the lead. I mentioned last week, I think this is going to be a new feature because people are doing this more and more in the journalistic profession. That is to say, where there's still journalism practiced. Which, since we're so back to normal, you know, there's no need for news on the news channels anymore. We can just yell at each other again about kidnappings. Tom Brokaw said this week, I don't have it on tape, but trust me, he said last summer when the news media were awash in stories about, shark bites, even though he was admitting that the news media inflated the whole shark bite, shark attack story last summer. But he said, but here's the story of a shark attack that's really serious. What he didn't say, of course, is that the news media are this summer inflating the child kidnapping stories way beyond their statistical commonality because, as I mentioned last week, the incidence of kidnappings is going down. And 90% of kidnappings, ladies and gentlemen, are by members of the kidnappee's family. That's why we got treated to the Chinese girl that was missing for a day and a half this week? That was national news. Okay, then. Anyway, so burying the lead. This is where you take the most important part of the story, which shouldn't be in the first paragraph in conventional journalistic practice, and bury it somewhere deep in the story for whatever reason. Because your stylistic dictates demand that you do some flourishes up front or for other reasons. Anyway, this is from the New York Times, July 30th, about Skylar Tilney, a managing director at Merrill Lynch who refused to testify in a congressional hearing this week about the relationship of Merrill Lynch to Enron. He had a special relationship with Enron is the thrust of the story. That was the lead. But here, deep down, his wife, Elizabeth A. Tilney, had even stronger ties. She was a senior Enron executive, a personal friend of the chairman, Kenneth Lay, and the marketing executive who in 1997 introduced the company's jazzy logo, the, quote, crooked E, unquote. The crooked E, ladies and gentlemen. How many people would have bought Enron stock if they'd known? I mean, just that's fair warning right there, the crooked E. Says it all. That's the logo for the company. You want a logo of a hand going into another pocket? The crooked E. And this in the burying, also the New York Times burying this lead in a story about Boston's Cardinal Law testifying in the case where his archdiocese in Boston backed out of a proposed settlement with some of the abuse victims of Father Gehegingen, however you pronounce that name. The very last paragraph of that story. Also today, like you should pay attention to this. Also today, the Archdiocesan Chancellor, David W. Smith, confirmed a report in the Boston Globe that the church has directed its lawyers to consider the possibility of filing for bankruptcy. That wouldn't be the headline. Catholic Church considers filing for bankruptcy. It says the church. I don't know if it means just the church in Boston or the whole shebang. But I'd put that up front, me, if I were running the world. But I'm barely running this show. I'm running this exclusive feature, however, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Cincinnati Reds general manager Jim Bowden. Bowden? Baseball fans, you tell me. Compared a potential baseball strike with the September 11th terrorist attacks and then proceeded to apologize for the remark. Bowden said before Cincinnati's victory over the Los Angeles Dodgers on Thursday that he doesn't expect a strike by major league players. Union head Donald Fehr has been meeting with players to brief them about the status of talks. If players want to strike, they ought to just pick September 11th, because that's what it's going to do to the game, Bowden said. I don't think there's going to be a work stoppage. I don't think anybody's that dumb. If they do walk out, make sure it's September 11th. Be symbolic. Let Donald Fehr drive the plane right into the building, if that's what they want to do. Unquote. Major League Baseball is reviewing the comments made by Bowden. After the game, the Reds released a statement by Bowden apologizing for the analogy. Quote, earlier today, while speaking to a group of reporters, I made a horrible comparison between baseball's labor situation and the tragedy of 9/11. I regret making such extremely insensitive remarks, and I apologize to anyone I may have offended. I am truly sorry. That's an apology, ladies and gentlemen. That's an apology and a half. And from baseball to higher education, Princeton University President Shirley Tilghman apologized Monday for snooping by at least one Princeton admissions officer into the online files of high school seniors who'd applied to a rival Yale University. Basic principles of privacy and confidentiality are at stake here, Tilghman wrote in an email to Princeton students and faculty. Violations of these principles, therefore, must not and will not be tolerated. She told students and her faculty in her email that students who apply to Princeton or any other university have every right to expect that information they provide in good faith will be used only for the purpose of... I don't see the apology, but I guess she made it. All right, so those people are sorry. What about you? Well, you didn't do anything. You don't have to be sorry. I just thought I could trick you there. Ladies and gentlemen, in the run-up to 9/11, the anniversary, it's clear that we've just gotten too damn normal. You know, we've been keeping track all year of how normal we've gotten, and the answer is TDM, too damn normal. So we're going to have to unnormalize. So airlines, which expect people to be leery of flying on September 11th, okay, I'll accept that, have cut service that day, especially on planes with similar itineraries to the planes hijacked and crashed a year earlier. I'm going to say the word out loud. That's superstition, okay? You can sue me if you want, but that's superstition. But anyway, airlines are dealing with it by cutting back flights on September 11th. Not only that, the Fox Broadcasting Network and Fox News Channel say they will not accept advertising for their September 11th coverage marking the one-year anniversary. The decision is expected to cost the two networks a combined $5 million. Why wouldn't they charge for the advertising, get the $5 million, and donate it to the families? This way, it just they're contributing it to nobody. They're contributing nothing to nobody. We just get to see more of their stuff. Or they could just give it to me. Maybe it's because I live in Park Slope, Brooklyn, but the more I thought about it, the more I thought it was not the right thing to do to solicit advertising, says Paul Rittenberg, head of sales for the Fox News Channel, which always does the right thing. You notice that? They always ask themselves, what would Paul Rittenberg do? Most of September 11th on Fox News Channel will be filled with programming commemorating the events a year earlier. Fox's broadcast network will do a 2.5-hour special of American Idol. No, a 2-hour primetime special that night. It doesn't say what. Advertisers have expressed a general reluctance to include their messages in what is expected to be somber programming that day. Dell Computer won't advertise on September 11th related coverage. Oh, no! We don't get to see the Dell dude on September 11th. The terrorists have won. The Dell dude takes a day off. Pepsi won't advertise on any program that day. Fox's competitors say they're still seeking both advertisers or sponsors who will underwrite the cost of coverage that day. They say Fox is simply giving up early. Rittenberg at Fox suggested advertisers may only participate on September 11th in return for price breaks during other times. Okay, so don't ever say Rupert never gave you anything. He's giving you a commercial-free day, September 11th. On the other hand, Time Warner Cable a subsidiary of AOL Time Warner, which is under an increased drumbeat of investigations, both by the Securities and Exchange Commission and this week now by the Justice Department over, say it with me now, accounting irregularities. Here's how they hope to make up for the possible fines that they may be levied in those investigations. Flood victims whose cable converters were destroyed during this month's heavy rains. I guess this is from Northern California. I don't know where these floods are. Some floods. Didn't flood in Northern California this month. Okay, wherever it flooded. Flood victims whose cable converters were destroyed during this month's heavy rains are being charged $300 for the damaged boxes by Time Warner Cable. We are sympathetic to them, says Karen Hartley, Vice President for Marketing and Communications at Time Warner, but we're going to charge them for the boxes. Maybe Rupert should take that company over. On September 11th, however, they won't be charged for their boxes, so. And finally, in the top of the news, ladies and gentlemen, a cell phone company in the United States plans to use actors and models to what's the difference? To create an artificial buzz around their new product. In what has been dubbed guerrilla marketing, the actors will interact directly with the public to promote a new cell phone from Sony Ericsson without telling people they are employees of the company. This is according to the Wall Street Journal. Technique involves 60 actors and actresses hanging around tourist attractions such as the Empire State Building and Seattle Space Needle, asking passers-by to take their photo. The actor then hands over the latest cell phone model from Sony Ericsson. Sony by Ericsson? Did I miss that? With a digital camera attachment and starts explaining how to use it and demonstrating the phone's feature. Another scheme has 60 actors and actresses, that seems to be the magic number, going to trendy bars and lounges armed with a new cell phone. In some cases, a lone model will receive a phone call from a friend while she's in the bar. The caller's picture appears on the phone's color screen. In other cases, the actresses present the completely believable scenario of two women on opposite ends of a bar playing an electronic version of Battleship with each other using their phones. All this is done without the owners of the bar or its patrons knowing that the women are working girls. But really working girls. The actors will only admit to working for the company if they are asked directly, according to John Marin, the company's director of marketing, who does admit to working for the company. Sony is paying a reported $5 million for the 60-day campaign. So, next time you see girls playing video games on the cell phone in the bar, be careful. They're working.
From CPR, Continental Public Radio, this is Book Bag. Book Bag. Chit and chat about the fascinating world inside the bindings. I'm Ira Zipkin in Washington. These are called the dog days of summer, but perhaps they should be called the book days of summer, since even the most reluctant of readers the rest of the year is settling down at the beach right now with what Poe might have called a volume of forgettable lore. But our subject today is a book of more enduring topical interest. The Major League Baseball players are threatening to go on strike against their owners later this month, shutting down yet another season of, if not the national pastime, at least the seasonal one. And we thought it was a most appropriate time to revisit the modern poet of baseball, a man among the boys of summer. A year without a World Series doesn't have to mean a year without a book from Robert Bloom, perhaps the most prolific of the modern school of baseball writers, who've long been celebrating a sport that now has nothing to celebrate. His newest book, The Year That Canceled Summer, is a chronicle of a personal odyssey through the baseball strike of 94. Robert Bloom, welcome back to the Book Bag.
Thank you, Ira.
I've been introducing you for so long as the baseball writer for The Atlantic Monthly, but that's changed too, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. The Atlantic said they wanted to de-emphasize baseball coverage for the coming century. And very fortuitously, National Geographic expressed some interest in my strike pieces, so they'll be appearing in shorter version in the magazine sometime after the publication date of the book. Mm-hmm. And then I'll be doing a bi-monthly baseball column for the Geographic if and when the sport resumes.
You don't sound optimistic.
Well, I get paid in any case, so...
I mean, about baseball.
It's the ability to encourage an almost fathomless act of protracted introspection that is baseball's great gift to the soul. On the other hand, predicting the outcome of labor squabbles is not, if I may, my money pitch.
Tell us about the year they canceled summer. It has a melancholy ring to it.
Ira, when the players walked out or were locked out, when the games stopped, it struck me that an empty baseball stadium was the perfect vantage point from which to view this struggle.
You're not being ironic.
Not intentionally. No, not only was the empty ballpark a perfect metaphor for an America in which the shells of things remain, but the contents have been hollowed out. The old beer brewery turned into a mall. Mm. But just as a place to be, a place to think, you'd be hard-pressed to find any place quieter than an empty stadium.
So in a sense, being in an unoccupied ballpark gave you more of what you like baseball for anyway.
In a way. That's one of the themes of the book, the constant interplay of loss and gain, as if life is a pennant race and that all we ever are really striving for is to avoid being mathematically eliminated.
You didn't just go to one shuttered ballpark, did you?
Well, that's how this project started. I figured I could get into Yankee Stadium pretty easy with my press pass. Parking would be a snap. And then it occurred to me that 27 other ballparks each had its own resonant frequency of silence. In each, the echoes of home runs hit and umpires booed would reverberate differently against the graying columns of time.
You're not referring to your columns.
No. Columns is a architectural support system for the ball games that we remember. The ball games that remember us. Anyway, the point of the exercise was to spend an afternoon in each one. Itself a task of reinvention, since in a lot of these parks they haven't played day baseball for years. As things turned out, I never could get Mrs. Schott or her people on the phone, so Riverfront Stadium is out of the first edition anyway. But otherwise, the book is a collection of the thoughts of a baseball fan watching 27 scheduled games not being played.
Has anyone ever done anything like this before?
In a way, there are stadium tours every spring before the season starts, but there you've got a group of at least 30, and the mood is one of expectation, of renewal, rebirth, of...
Of all those good things. Robert, yeah. Could you read us a passage from The Year That Canceled Summer?
Sure. This was a very hot day in the middle of August, Dodger Stadium in Los Angeles, about 3:45. Would flags have fluttered in such a flaccid excuse for a breeze? No way to know, for no banners had been run up the flagpole today, no bright exemplars of hope and pride fluttered from the metal pole that separates us from them, player from spectator, fair from foul. Was I hungrier knowing that a hot dog wasn't available just 100 yards away, or was it a hunger for something that couldn't be satisfied by a few ounces of ground and spiced Schweinfleisch? If there were to be bungled calls this afternoon, they would be mine. No man in blue would be recommended for ophthalmological examination during this blistering interlude, so no satisfaction could be wrung from contemplation of man's fallibility. In this stadium, so blessed by weather and custodial care that it looks almost as new as a rookie from Albuquerque, a sign of age would have been reassuring today, a promise that not all the decay was happening on our insides. In this stadium where the voice of broadcast of Vin Scully can be heard from thousands of little radios echoing through the grandstands during each game, today I turned on my radio. From my box seat, the angry tenor of former police chief Dowell Gates resounded across the field, taking phone calls. The grass, blessedly uncognizant of the trampling it was not getting, continued to grow. Here and there, a patch turned brown.
Here and there, a patch turned brown. What a strikingly imaginative image.
Thank you. Also, it's dry in L.A. and the Dodgers have cut back on watering.
Robert Bloom, does it occur to you these days that you may have given back to baseball more than baseball is now giving to you?
What I discovered on my journey, among other things, is that they can take baseball, the game, away from us. But baseball, the idea of baseball, that has no owners' committee, no acting commissioner, no union spokesman. And at the end of each one of these encounters with our own mortality as reflected in the unscuffed base paths, no one had won, but no one had lost.
Almost hockey-like in its suggestion of indecision. Robert Bloom, as usual, you've given us too much to think about. Your new book is The Year They Canceled Summer, and it's sure to seem like must-reading during the comparatively exciting off-season ahead. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
Thank you, Ira.
And that will fold the page and put away this edition of The Book Bag. We had support today from the Forestry Foundation, reminding you that without forestry, books would be written on the wind. Join us next time for another look at life in that special place between the table of contents and the index. For now, I'm Ira Zipkin, Zipkinning up The Book Bag. This is CPR, Continental Public Radio.
together by some design. Well, that sure make it easy for poor fools to fight. And I'll take no chance beyond the parish line. Wheels are turning, but how did the pace me by?
Ladies and gentlemen, it's a tough battle to fight these technological wars. Sony recently released a CD of music from and inspired by the Spider-Man movie. The CD carries the familiar warning, now familiar, that it will not play on your computer because it is copy protected using Sony's Key 2 audio system. We've talked about this. As a promotion for the film, however, the CD also promises that with your copy of the Spider-Man CD and a connection to the internet, you'll have access to exclusive behind-the-scenes video footage, music videos, and more. The instructions to get that stuff are, 1, place the Spider-Man CD in your computer's CD-ROM drive. 2, log on to Spider-Man.com. 3, click on Get Connected. People at New Scientist magazine were intrigued by the idea of a CD intended not to work on a computer while simultaneously being intended to work on a computer. At New Scientist, they found the CD's music played perfectly well on a Windows PC. It also copied perfectly well to a blank CD and happily ripped to computer hard disk. Quote, we then tried to follow Sony's instructions for getting connected to the internet. After a while, up came the hopeful invitation to insert the CD and press start. But all this brought was the error message, quote, we were unable to find Spider-Man. So the thing it's supposed to do, it doesn't, and the thing it's not supposed to do, it does. Good work, guys. The Wall Street Journal says things are looking up for digital TV. The San Jose Mercury News says things are looking bad. Nothing illustrates the faltering digital television revolution, says the Mercury News, as well as the furor over a tuner. It's a cluster of circuitry and silicon that would allow a digital television to receive over-the-air broadcasts. One prominent congressman described it as the largest impediment to the digital television transition. The FCC commissioner, or the chairman, calls on manufacturers to voluntarily install broadcast tuners in half of all big-screen digital TVs over the next 2 years. But the consumer electronics industry is not eager to cooperate, responding that the tuner mandate is about as useful to consumers as slapping a pair of training wheels on a Harley. It only benefits the 7% of Americans who use rooftop antennas to receive broadcasts. It won't help the 85 million who receive their TV programming via cable or satellite. But that's good news for the Wall Street, I guess. I don't know why the Wall Street Journal feels encouraged, but they do. There's a big debate, as you know, brewing. Senator Joseph Biden held hearings this week on the continuing series of leaks from the administration about plans for an invasion or an attack by the United States, a preemptive strike against Iraq. Not mentioned during those debates so far, that debate in this country, is this fact, which came from a British newspaper today. The British government has launched an investigation into cancers among Gulf War veterans after figures disclosed the incidence of lymphatic cancer among troops who served in Iraq is almost twice the normal level. Veterans' organizations claim the cancers may have been caused by depleted uranium shells used in the conflict. So while we're debating whether we should go to Iraq, let's debate whether we should use, when we do go to Iraq, whether we should use the depleted uranium shells anymore. Can we? Can we do that? Of course, the debate goes on in Washington, although everybody's clearing out of Washington, including President George W. Bush. He headed up to Maine over the weekend to do some golfing and boating with his dad, who was recovering from some skin treatment to remove some keratoses non-cancerous lesions caused by sun exposure. George W. then goes down to the ranch at Crawford for a three-week, it's not a vacation. So this weekend he didn't even need to use the phone to reach 41.
Come on, Ball.
Yeah. Not a bad little drive for an old fella, 41.
Hey. Let your nine iron do your talking for you. Just pretend it's Ari Fleischer.
You know, that's so retributory. Mm-hmm. You're just bitter because my face isn't as full of red spots as a map of suspected Iraqi weapons depots.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Get down there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm tired. Haven't gotten a full 12 hours sleep in two or three weeks now.
Look, you're going to get down to that godforsaken ranch of yours for 3 weeks, although how that piece of moonscape could make anybody except Neil Armstrong more relaxed is a puzzler. But
yeah, well, to tell you the God's honest truth, 41, this whole Maine deal to me is all shell and no lobster.
You never seemed to mind it when we made you come up here.
I think it's your shot.
And as for these swellings, they'll go down by Thursday. Mm-hmm. It's just today, all these little things, they froze off. They sting like hell. How are you? Shoot. So, that's why you put on the sunscreen, right, 43?
Oh, yes, sir.
Yeah, because even though the Secret Service guys are umbrellaing you over there, you know, some UV rays can penetrate most umbrella fabric.
Yeah.
Learned that when I was in the company.
The agency.
The whatever. Yeah. Go ahead. Let's see what you got there, cowboy.
Hey, I'm in no hurry. Mm. Only thing I'm doing tonight is going to dinner with you and Mom. Like I said in my impromptu statements about Iraq, I'm a patient man.
Yeah. Yeah, 43, listen, about the Iraqi deal. Hold on.
You bad boy. Yeah, look, Jesus, these leaks from the Pentagon are something weird, huh?
Yeah.
You know, it's like I told Don Rumsfeld this week. I thought we were all on the same side here, but these fellas in American uniforms who go leaking top secret, not even plans to the New York freaking Times, well, it's like Ashcroft says, we should just send them down to Guantanamo and lube them up for the Afghans.
Yeah. What's he mean by that?
You know, John, just something that'll keep him in the running for dormitory pinup boy at Bob Jones University, but...
it's a stress.
What is?
But look, the guy you gotta watch out for is Colin.
Oh, Colin's a good man, but what's the stress?
Hold on. Your slice. Usually that's stress.
It's not stress, and it's a hook.
Well, 43 now. Never did insist that you go after Saddam to clear my name, thinking the eyes of history, our choice to not go to Baghdad was defensible. But if you're going to do this thing, how come Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney, two of the toughest nut crunchers in the business, can't keep these general fellas and Colin from leaking like a Yucca Mountain nuclear waste receptacle?
Not a slice? Long and straight, like a basketball player's woozle. Look, 41, I think we learned from your war in Iraq that a good, honest, protractory Senate debate is a perfect curtain raiser. That's what Jimmy Baker always used to call it.
Hey. It's Jim Baker's fault you got this mess on your table. He was the one always used to say, just wave in the Kurds, Saddam will be gone faster than kitchen help in an INS raid. Don't think he gets quoted on this subject.
Ashcroft has a good idea. Anybody who publishes national security information without a go-ahead from us gets a one-way ticket to an upper bunk in Cuba.
Well,
see, John's the kind of guy you want to have in a foxhole with you, because he's the kind of guy that's just going to say, the heck with it, let's just put all these folks in orange jumpsuits and be done with it, you know?
Yeah.
Get something done kind of guy.
Hey, Colin's getting something done, too. He's orchestrating a campaign to keep us, to keep you from achieving regime change.
Yeah.
Just saying. Saddam's no dummy. Now he offers to let the inspectors back in, and there goes what's left of your coalition.
Coalition? Mm-hmm. Heck, 41, we haven't had a coalition since Tora Bora Bora. Yeah, it's like Rumsfeld says, everybody's very happy to have us do their dirty work, as long as they can watch safely from the sidearms.
Mm, definitely a slice. Now, don't get me wrong, definitely think you got bragging rights about the corporate reform bill whizzing through Congress like moose through a goose, but...
Hey, hey, and don't forget the tax cut.
Last year's news. Anyway, just saying, if Colin outmaneuvers Cheney on this Iraq deal, you may have a new vice president next 4 years. This one you can't keep in a bunker. War on terrorism or...
Hey, 41, thanks for the advice, but as I said in my press avails, I am a patient man.
Yeah?
And that's it. No questions.
Okay. Just telling you, you're going to get rid of that slice before you get rid of Saddam.
You're just too marvelous for words like glorious, glamorous, and that'll stand by amorous. You're just too wonderful, I'll never find the words that say enough, or drill enough. I just don't think they're swell enough. You're much too much, and just too very, very to ever be in Webster's dictionary. And so I'm borrowing a love song from the birds to tell you that you're marvelous, too marvelous for words.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this edition of the show. I have to go find a payphone. So the program will return next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the American Forces Network, on shortwave at WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz, and anywhere in the world you want it, whenever you want it, on your computer at two locations, I'm talking about the show, www.harryshearer.com and www.kcrw.com. And it would be just like having known about the crooked E before, if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? All righty. Thank you very much. Uh-huh. The only thing she didn't figure out, the marketing whiz at Enron who came up with the crooked E, was the slogan, the crooked E is for extra EP. New York show. But the whole family can enjoy it. The email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack. And note to Bill Simon Jr., if you're still looking for investment ideas, the Smith Corona Typewriter Company might be a good bet. You know, because no matter how many people have computers, they're still going to need typewriters. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world, still and forever, as the home of the homeless.